Restaurant Unstoppable, episode 1074 with Doug Turbush.
I always say, if I'm walking around here pissed off, it's because somebody is stepping on the neck of one of my core values. And that's it.
Are you ready for it factors, success stories, failures, and bombs of restaurant industry knowledge? Then, join Eric Cacciatore and today's incredible guest as they share what it takes to become unstoppable.
Imagine you had an employee who never called out, kept inventory in line, could spit out sales and cost data at a moment's notice, and saved you hours of work. You'd want to hire that person, right? Margin Edge is the boost in efficiency you need and doesn't add to your labor cost. Margin Edge is a complete restaurant management software that allows you to seamlessly manage all aspects of your business from one central location. With Margin Edge, you can track food costs in real time, make inventory faster and less tedious, easily cost out your recipes, and get a daily P&L so you always know where you stand. Visit marginedge.com/unstoppable to learn more and to get a free monthly restaurant sales report packed with exclusive industry trends, data, and insights. Once more, that's Margin Edge, marginedge.com/unstoppable. This episode made possible by Restaurant Technologies, Inc. RTI's Total Oil Management automates your entire cooking oil process. With Total Oil Management, you get dependable, fresh bulk cooking oil delivery, filtration plus oil usage monitoring and reporting, easy oil disposal, use cooking oil pickup and recycling, and say goodbye to messy, dangerous restaurant rendering tanks. Yuck. RTI's end-to-end cooking oil system helps you manage your used cooking oil disposal, storage, collection, and recycling conveniently, safely, and cleanly with no upfront cost. Restaurant Technologies, Inc. is always on, so you don't have to be. To learn more, head to RTI-Inc.com and let them know Restaurant Unstoppable Podcast sent you their way. This podcast was made possible by Restaurant Systems Pro, and we need to let you know that every second and fourth Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, CEO of Restaurant Systems Pro, Fred Langley, will be going live, where he'll cover what you need to know about running a profitable restaurant from soup to nuts. This live event will reveal the steps to manage the service and financial goals for your restaurant's productivity. To learn more, head to go.restaurantsystemspro.net/restaurantunstoppable. This episode brought to you by Owner.com. Owner.com is the leading all-in-one platform for restaurant marketing. Owner.com powers everything from SEO-optimized websites, direct online ordering, automated email and text marketing, built-in loyalty programs, zero-commission delivery, and branded mobile apps for your restaurant that's integrated right into your POS. With Owner.com, there's no contract, no hidden fees, and nothing to lose. Join thousands of restaurant owners using Owner.com to grow direct online sales, save thousands in third-party fees, and simplify their online ordering presence all in one. Book a free demo today at owner.com/unstoppable and see why owner.com is the number one rated restaurant marketing software. With excitement, allow me to introduce to you today's guest, chef owner of Seed Kitchen and Bar and Stem Wine Bar, Chef Doug Turbush. Doug, my man, are you feeling unstoppable today?
Unstoppable.
Absolutely. Yeah, man. I'm stoked to be here, man. This isn't the first time we've met. I think we've met at least two or three times now. Is that right?
Yep.
And we met through the Restaurant Assistance Pro Elite Group. It's an elite mastermind group where all the top performers of the Restaurant Assistance Pro folks come together. I love what Fred is doing with that group and the way you guys all support each other and you take it on the chin and you like really lean into each other. It's like, get into what that is. What's your interpretation of the support group or the elite group?
Yeah, it's an awesome group. It's, you know, it goes beyond a basic mastermind in that we get together four times a year, usually in someone else's restaurant around the country and kind of share ideas and share feedback. And, you know, basically this is the kind of core group of people that I can rely on when I have a situation, I have a problem that I don't know how to handle, I can, instead of asking my competitor down the street, right. who's not going to give me any answers,
right.
Talk to someone that's not in my in my jurisdiction and can really give me some guidance.
Yeah. So. And every quarter somebody hosts it, and everybody who from across the country goes into that restaurant, they look around and they give constructive criticism. Mm-hmm. It's really cool. And it's been a privilege to be able to be a fly on the wall to experience that. I'm actually headed to the, Fred Langley is hosting the next one in Arizona. Is he actually hosting it in the sense of like, he doesn't own a restaurant in Arizona, does he?
No. But that's where their headquarters are. So you'll probably get to go around corporate headquarters and see all that stuff. So it'll be interesting. Yeah.
I'm looking forward to it. So that's where I'm headed. I can't wait to dive into more of your story to find out how you got to where you are today. But let's get that motivational, inspirational. Did I already ask you this? Or we just talked about it beforehand?
Kind of talked about
it. You haven't shared it yet. I was like, wait a second. Let's get that motivational, inspirational ball rolling with a success quote or a mantra. What do you got for us?
Make it nice or make it twice.
Make it nice or make it twice. That's a good one, man. Why did you choose that one? Why is that important to
you? I've been in the kitchen since I was 15. So, it's just a easy, simple quote, but it's very... It drives your efficiency. It's kind of how I approach everything in the kitchen and how I approach just my basic philosophies of do this right now, slowly, correctly, or you're going to waste your time over and over again.
So, right, absolutely. Yeah. And that's kind of what I was thinking listening to you talk is it's not just applicable to the kitchen.
Sure.
It's life. Like, do it right the first time, especially opening a restaurant. Like, it's not cheap to open a restaurant. You don't get many times a second chance because everything you have, sometimes you refinance your house, you know, to be able to do it. If you don't do it right the first time, you might not get a second chance.
Yeah. Been there, done that.
Right. Let's get into it then.
Yeah.
So where does it make sense to start sharing your story? Take us to the beginning.
Okay. I started cooking or not cooking. I started cleaning restaurants when I was 15. So, my buddy of mine had a job at a local restaurant and nothing I really was interested in. Just, I needed money to go buy guitars and things I liked when I was 12 years old. So, I got a job there and, I was kind of, I guess it was below the dishwasher. I was cleaning like, the hoods with, Easy Off, back then, no mask, no gloves, just the dirty job of the world, in the restaurant world.
Did you get worried about those times and like how it might knock some years off the...
Yeah,
I used to do the same thing too, and I looked back at it like it would burn my hands.
Yes,
and I was like, I didn't even think twice about it.
Yeah, and you just
hold your breath and get to town.
Yeah, it was awful, but we got through it. And then from there, I guess, kind of got out of the restaurant game. Well, didn't think I wanted to go into restaurants, and I wasn't the greatest high school student, but I kind of thought hotels were pretty glamorous, so I'd go to hotel restaurant management school because it was kind of, that's all I knew. I didn't have the greatest grades, and I was like, let's do hotels. Those are big and glamorous, but one thing you realize about hotels quickly is that they never close, and it's not the easiest lifestyle. So I chose restaurants, super simple, easy lifestyle.
Right. So at this point, so when you're in college, did you know that this is what you want to do for the rest of your life?
It took me through about my second or third year in college when I took a hot foods class. It was kind of a required class of your hotel restaurant management degree. And I ran into a professor there, Phil McGurk, who's, I think he's still around. He was in our restaurant a few years ago. But he was kind of a big 6'5" tall, with a chef toque on, and ran that kitchen like nobody's business, like super organized. He was very disciplined in his approach to everything. And it was the first time I kind of saw a kitchen that was really run well and wasn't kind of the nightmare I was living in high school. And I was just really impressed by that. And he kind of took me under his wing during that class and was like, at the end of the semester or whatever, he was like, you kind of got a knack for this. Have you ever thought about culinary school? And I had no idea that even existed. And you heard about CIA or whatever. But anyway, he ended up helping me get my application going for after my four-year degree to go to culinary school after. So it was kind of my next venture was to go to CIA where he had graduated. And he helped me get a little scholarship there and got things underway. So
nice.
Yeah.
So what was... Knowing what you know, this is a conversation I'm always curious to hear what people have to say. Knowing what you know now, where you are now, would you have gone to culinary school or would you give people advice to go to culinary school or would you do it on your own?
Would I do it again? 100%.
Yeah.
Why I mean, that? I love the experience. I loved just the exposure to all the different types of cuisine under one roof.
Yeah.
It's totally what you make it. I mean, right. if you put in 100%, you're hitting the culinary library, you know, on the weekends instead of the bars every weekend. It's like, I mean, I had a little balance there,
yeah,
but
you gotta find balance.
But I mean, you really got to put. It's what you put into it. And I think, you know, CIA is a very unique experience in that you're under all these, you know, acclaimed chefs that have really been through it. And, you know, the local culinary scene, like, it's almost non-existent here in Atlanta now, which is kind of sad because I had a number of students that would come and intern here and really, you know, Le Cordon Bleu and Art Institute and Chattahoochee Tech up the street, they're all gone, you know, and they were here 10 years ago. So the local culinary school, it's hard to say, yes, that would be worth it. But if you can get into a place like Johnson & Wales, CIA, something like that, for me, it's like you can't beat that experience.
I've 100% noticed a pattern that the people that do the best when they go to CIA or Johnson & Wales or any of those culinary schools, they're usually not straight out of high school. They're usually...
Right.
You know, they've been around, they've found out that they're passionate about it. And when they go hard.
Yeah.
And the professors see something in them. And I think the biggest value that culinary school has today is the amount of doors can open for you. If you really give it all you have and you have a natural talent for it, like doors are going to open like so fast. You can go anywhere in the world.
Yeah. I don't disagree. I mean, it was amazing. Like, you know, I had an internship lined up at Charlie Trotter's back in the day. He was like the number one chef in the country. I ended up not being able to take it because he didn't pay anything back then, and I wasn't of the background that would work. So,
what are your thoughts on that? Do you have opinions?
Yeah, I mean, I've got opinions. It's, you know, and I'll be perfectly honest. We have interns that are unpaid here from a local culinary school, and it's, you know, on a limited basis, and you've never been in a kitchen. And it's part of your education program, then maybe a few hours will, I mean, I think it maxes out at like 20 hours here, but I don't mind it. I think it's really hard to walk into a professional kitchen like this and be like, hey, I'm ready to go, you know,
right.
and have that sort of experience that demands, you know, the pay that it does. But yeah, as part of education, I'm okay with on a limited basis. But other than that, like, that was a 6-month internship that was like, I had to live in Chicago. And
right.
That was not happening.
So. I think it's case by case, you know, like, totally. And I think to your point, yeah, if it's part of a, you mean, I didn't get paid to go fly airplanes around when I was learning how to be a pilot.
Right.
You're like, I had to go
practice,
do it on my own time and pay for it. Like, you need to get that the repetitions in. So from that perspective, I'm with you for sure. It's weird. Like, I don't know, like, I do think that the Charlie Trotters of the world, the French Laundries of the world, I mean, where they're probably making the most money, you know, and they get the lowest labor, it kind of seems like an imbalance sometimes.
Absolutely. I mean, he was killing it. He was at the top of his game, world recognized.
But people, you're getting more than a paycheck there. You're getting to say, I worked at the French Laundry.
Right.
And I think there's also an argument to that, is like that alone is going to open doors for you. So, like, it's not a straightforward answer, don't think.
But I mean, that kitchen churned out some of the best chefs in the country.
Yeah, you know? No doubt.
Yeah.
No doubt, for sure. You're getting an education going there, absolutely.
Yeah.
So reflecting back at this time when you're a young guy in culinary school in the mid-90s, what's the vision you have for yourself? Did you see yourself someplace? Did you have a dream?
Yeah. I think I'm kind of living it. It took me a while, but it was to open my own place, and I knew that in culinary school. It was just a matter of... what were the best next steps to take to try and get me there? Because I, you know, I hadn't any real professional cooking experience before culinary school. So once I got out of there, I just had to find places where I could, you know, build the chops for it.
So, yeah. So when did you think you'd have when did you think you'd open your first place?
When you're young, you think it's going to happen, you know, 5-6 years, whatever, down the road. Let me get some good experience under my belt and then move on. I was a little bit more like my parents. Like if I found a place I wanted to be, I'd stay there a really long time. And I did that, you know, here in Atlanta. So
I mean, you did 4 years. So I'm assuming you were probably 4 years at the University of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Then another year. So you're what? Probably 23 years old when you graduate CIA, 24?
Yeah, somewhere in there. Culinary school was almost 2 years at that time.
So 25, we'll call it. 25 years old, mid-20s.
Yeah.
So you're thinking in your early 30s you're going to open your first restaurant?
Yep, rock and roll.
And when did you open your first restaurant?
I was 39.
Yeah. Do you think that it was better that you took time to go get the experience, or do you think that you were maybe too cautious?
No, I think it was a godsend for me. I mean, it was very valuable experience. Understanding the business part of it. Even when I opened my restaurant at 39, I had no idea of the business side of running restaurants.
I can't wait to listen about the crash course you got.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was a huge part of my learning curve, I guess, once you decide to become an entrepreneur. Yeah.
So I see you're working in restaurants while you're in school. You know, I see the Packing House restaurant. I see the management internship, the Marriott's, food service manager, we already talked about that, Stout. Culinary arts intern, American Club, 5 years. So like, Kupa, am I saying that right? Kupa?
Yeah.
Kupa.
Yeah.
So that was like your first, like, looks like after college job, I want to say it looks like, or maybe it was the American Club.
Out of culinary school, I lived in, outside of Minneapolis, but I worked in Minneapolis for a couple of years at a place called Goodfellows, which was a restaurant that
I
was
love Minneapolis. Sorry to interrupt.
It was, well, you won't love it in the middle of winter, but
that's a good point.
Yeah. But Stephen Piles, who was kind of still is a famous Southwestern chef, had opened a restaurant there in Minneapolis, and it was the best restaurant in Minneapolis at the time. So that's where I went. Every city I moved to, I was just like, let's find the best restaurant and go there. And that ended up being a really good experience, really fine cuisine, really good to kind of build those chops I was looking to build out of culinary school. And then 2 years after that, my wife had gotten recruited by Coca-Cola over in Thailand, and I was like, well, we got to go do that because that's every chef's dream.
Yeah, for sure. So I'm definitely going back to Thailand. I spent together 6 months in Thailand. Yeah. So when I first started this podcast, I would go live on the road for 4 months at a time and get content scheduled 4 months into the future, and then go live in Thailand because I couldn't afford to live anywhere else.
Right.
It was the most expensive part was getting there, $600 cheap ticket. And then for like $150 a month, you can live like a king.
Yeah.
It was
amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing. The food is so amazing. How was your experience there? How long were you there?
We were there about 13 months. I wish we could have been there longer, but it was the Asian economic crisis of whatever that was. The late 90s had hit pretty hard, so they were pretty much clearing out job after job.
Were you working in restaurants?
Yeah, I had found an Australian lady that was going to open sort of a high-end coffee shop / cafe and turn into dinner and everything else. But I had applied for that job, and she took a fresh kid out of culinary school, and I guess out of culinary school with a year experience, and trusted me to open her restaurant after she kind of tasted through some of my food. And it was a really unique experience. Got that place open, rolling, had a 100% Thai staff, which was like, had to learn that quick, or enough of that quick. And, teach those guys how to cook some sandwiches and some nice entrees for dinner and pasta and stuff like that. So it was a cool place. It's still there today. So,
I mean, relative to American culture, working in Thailand, Thai culture, how would you say we stack up in terms of like
workplace culture?
Yeah.
Yeah. We're leaps and bounds ahead of it. I mean, it's very much sort of a class divided society over there. So you're kind of on cooks and are still generally at the bottom of the totem pole, and the pay was absolutely like laughable. But not to them. It's a local salary, right?
Right. So it's also the cost of living out there is also very low, relatively speaking. It's amazing how much people just don't want there. You know what I'm saying? Right. That's the one thing that I took away, was just how happy people were for what they had.
Yeah.
And what they had was each other. There's the sense of community there, I remember being really strong. Where were you? What city were you in?
Bangkok.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, super friendly people. I mean, they have the saying that's maipanarai, that's okay, you know? So everything's just kind of okay. Yeah. It's going to happen. So, yeah, it's definitely a different culture, but hard workers just like put in the time. They're there to support their family, and they build a little community in their restaurant. So I would say within the, you know, within that group, they're very well connected, but it's, you know, it was owned by a lady that owned the largest sugarcane fields in Thailand. So it was a big divide between what the culture was actually doing. Yeah,
so. I hear you. Okay, so you come back to America after 13 months in Thailand. You get this cool experience. That making you a better chef, would you say?
Thailand?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
How?
So my wife's Thai, and we, you know, originally we were living with the rest of the Thai family, right, as you do in Asia. And
you don't marry a person, you marry the whole family.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, I got to, my most valuable experience was not in that restaurant. It was in the house with her mom and going to the backyard, which is where you have the coal-fired stove on the ground, and learning to make those curries from scratch and learning to make, you know, all the different noodle dishes and all the different vegetable dishes and all this stuff. Just
papaya salad's my favorite.
Absolutely.
Even the process of making it and just holding and chopping, man. Sorry, I'm getting a little nostalgic right now.
No, it's an addictive, amazing dish that is super
just
popular.
Culture generally. It's amazing culture. I just love it over there. I'm definitely going back as soon as I can. Okay, so back to this, it made you a better chef.
Yeah.
What was it? You were saying just the tie to like the culture, the process. Where were you going with that thought before I got distracted with papaya?
No, it was, like I said, it was really with my mother-in-law and kind of learning the authentic dishes passed down from generation to generation. No notes, no books. They don't have anything they're working out of. I mean, they're working purely off of what her mom showed her.
Petition.
Yeah. And to learn those dishes, it was probably the most valuable stuff. I mean, I took copious notes and just got those recipes down. And that was just something that proved to be valuable later to learn all that stuff.
Gotcha. Yeah. So looking, I'm cheating here and looking at your LinkedIn profile.
Yeah.
So you mentioned Goodfellas, you're a sous chef at Nava, Blue Point. From 99 to 2001, 2001 to 2004, you're the executive chef at Nava, 2004 to 2011. So this is when, at this point, you joined the Buckhead Life Restaurant Group.
Correct.
1999 as a sous chef at Nava. Is it safe to say that this is kind of where you grew the most as a professional?
Yeah, I'd say so. I actually started as a line cook at Nava. Probably cut out my extensive resume details there. But yeah, I started as a line cook under Kevin Rathbun in town. He's a very well-known chef in the city, and I actually had known him through a connection at Goodfellas, so got an interview with him, and he was the first actual chef I met in Atlanta and kind of helped me get started in the city. So
would you say he was a mentor?
Absolutely, Kevin.
What did he teach you that you didn't have before, aside from food?
Aside from food? Just bold flavors, balance of flavors.
What about leadership? Leadership, how to manage people.
Hard not to follow Kevin. He's about 6'7", 350 at the time. And he was just, you have to look up to Kevin.
Imposing.
But he's, you know, he's very, he's real smooth. He's a cool dude. He's like, you want to hang out with him? He's hanging out, smoking cigars. He's just one of those chefs that's like, this guy is one in a million, and you kind of felt it from day one.
Yeah. So what, during this time, 1999 to 2011, right? 12 years.
Yeah.
Who were you going into that? Who were you coming out of that? What was your personal evolution during this time?
Sure. Yeah, I was a pretty timid. I'm pretty quiet guy in general, but I was very timid on the inside of what I was walking into with these, you know, $4 and $5 and $6 million restaurants that are, you know, at the time Buckhead Life was, and I, you know, today the same could be said, but they're the top of their game. They were the biggest restaurant group in Atlanta at the time. I think that may have changed by now, but they were, you know, Panna was doing things that no one had ever seen in the city and opening just restaurant after restaurant post Olympics. That was just like, amazing to see, and it was the group to be in. And I think, you know, walking into it, being that timid little line cook, I had to learn leadership. And, you know, you learn leadership in this business because the next guy that you want his job, you see the sous chef, right? And he's going to screw up.
Right.
And usually it's real quick.
Was there a struggle for you going into this big organization? Was there a challenge at all?
No, I mean, I felt like I was in the right place. I think they were very welcoming, and it is a great group, and they kind of it was just hard to be not admire what they had, which was, you know, 12 or 13 restaurants at the time in this small area of Buckhead, and it's huge. So
you said you were timid. How long did that last?
I think, yeah, once you get in your groove into the cook and you get to, I was in a new city. I don't know what the South is all about. You know, I'm a northern boy from Wisconsin.
Yeah.
So I think once I got over, that didn't take long. You get a few nights out with your cook buddies and you figure it out pretty quickly. And I think, you know, as a sous chef, that's not an option anymore. I mean, you've got to lead people. And I seem to have a knack for that and just kind of getting people in the right place. I'm very organized in the way I do things. And I was a pretty quick line cook. And at the time, I mean, you're surrounded by 95% Latino line cooks that are the fastest thing you've ever seen.
Right.
And I think I could keep up, but I had that respect, you know?
Yeah.
So
how did you get the respect?
Yeah, just side by side, helping them, you know, plating up their starch for them when they're, you know, laying out all their plates for them, getting stuff ready for them, really just giving them a hand because, you know, like, they're going to do it better.
Right.
So whatever you can do to help them kind of helps build that respect.
Got it. So just basically doing the unexpected, just like you'd get the respect from your guests.
Right.
You know, it's all relationships at the end of the day.
Exactly.
So you continue to evolve. I think actually now is a good time to take a break to thank our sponsors. When we come back, we'll talk about the transition to sous chef to executive chef, because I'm sure that was probably the first time you were ever an executive chef.
Yeah. And I was pretty young at the time.
Yeah. Awesome. Picture this. It's the end of the month and you're working your way through a shoebox full of invoices and manually entering costs into a janky spreadsheet that is being held together by bubblegum and prayers. And after hours of eye-stabbing tedium, you realize that your numbers don't even match. Oh my God. We've all been there. But it doesn't have to be this hard. Margin Edge can free you from spreadsheet hell. That's because Margin Edge is a complete restaurant management software that automates invoice processing and shows you your food costs and labor in real time. Just snap a picture of your invoice and Margin Edge takes it from there. Margin Edge will process your invoices automatically with line item detail and combine that information with sales from your POS to give you real-time reporting, including a daily P&L, up-to-date plate costs, and updated inventory count sheets. Stop spending hours to get numbers you're not 100% confident in when you could spend minutes and have accurate, real-time food and labor costs. Visit marginedge.com/unstoppable to learn more and to get a free monthly restaurant sales report packed with exclusive industry trends, data, and insights.
This episode is brought to you by Restaurant Technologies, Inc. RTI's Total Oil Management automates your entire cooking oil process. With Total Oil Management, you get dependable fresh bulk cooking oil delivery, filtration plus oil usage monitoring and reporting, easy oil disposal, used cooking oil pickup and recycling, and say goodbye to those messy, dangerous restaurant rendering tanks. Yuck. RTI's end-to-end cooking oil system helps you manage your used cooking oil disposal, storage, collection, and recycling conveniently, safely, and cleanly with no upfront cost. RTI's services are not limited to oil. They also provide insurance premiums and automated hood cleaning solutions plus hood filtration systems, making your hood cleaning process easy, automatic, and worry-free. In addition to all this, Restaurant Technologies, Inc. can help you reduce your carbon footprint, which we all know is becoming increasingly more important to the consumer. Restaurant Technologies, Inc. is always on, so you don't have to be. To learn more, head to RTI-Inc.com and let them know Restaurant Unstoppable Podcast sent you their way.
We're back, and this is the next thing in your timeline. The year's 2001, you become executive chef. Was this something that you saw coming? Was it out of the blue, or was there, you know, get into like that opportunity?
Yeah, I mean, I was a sous chef at the time, I guess, and was kind of into maybe a year into it. And one of the executive chef at the time, or the chef de cuisine at the time, under Kevin, had, I think he had a buddy that was in the in 9/11 in the towers.
Oh man!
And so he was like, "I'm moving back to New York," blah blah blah. So it was kind of sudden, and yeah, they presented me with that opportunity, and I think I was 28 or 29 at the time. So, and that was a very busy restaurant. I mean,
so it got a little blindsided because it wasn't like there was a conversation leading up to it. Like somebody left and you had to,
yeah,
you had to move up.
Yeah.
Were you ready?
No, but yes, there was no hesitation on my part. Yeah.
Yeah. But so reflecting back, you didn't feel ready is what I'm hearing, but you were ready in the sense that like you stepped up to the challenge.
Yeah. When I look back at my career, like, the only thing I would have changed was 2 years cooking here, 2 years cooking there, 2 years cooking here, and, you know, just more of that. See those different kitchens, see those different work with those different chefs.
Why?
I just think that's a great foundation. I mean, I had the foundation of culinary school, but that doesn't hold a candle to working under Keller and then Jean-Georges and then Trotter and then, you know. So when I look back, I was like, you should have done that. But I didn't necessarily have the means to do that either.
What do you think you'd have today if you had done that? Just the perspective?
I would think, just a little bit more of that, I guess, that hard drive in your head where you can go back and pick out that dish from here and pick out that dish from here. And you don't have to necessarily, I've had to pull a lot of stuff out of books and make it happen on the plate, which I'm pretty good at, but it's just, if you have that already ingrained, then you don't need that.
And it's more than just recipes too. It's leadership styles. It's how they run their business. It's all that perspective. And, I think there's something to be said about tenure and climbing the ladder and, especially when you're on a part of a restaurant group like Buckhead Life Restaurant Group, that's the leader. If you get your foot in that door, like, you know, take it as far as you can.
Absolutely.
You know? So there's pros and cons to both. You probably have more security than other people, you know, living that lifestyle, I would imagine. Is that safe to say?
Yeah. And I had, I had part of my decision in going into Buckhead Life was I had heard they had a restaurant that was going to be Asian focused, and I just was coming off this new recipes from Thailand, and I was like, how do I get there? And my first stop was Nava, which was Southwestern cuisine, which I had some experience in, but wasn't really my passion. Asian food was where I wanted to be, and that's where we went next. So
you're at Nava from 2001 to 2004.
Yeah.
And then from 2004 to 2011, you're at Blue Point. What's that?
Blue Point?
Yeah.
Oh, so Blue Point was kind of like the CNBC, giant, massive restaurant on the corner of Peachtree and Lenox in Buckhead, catty corner from the Ritz, just like celebrity hangout restaurant that they kind of, it was a real glammy restaurant that they had put a lot of money into. And at the time, it was Asian fusion and sushi, and that was
nice, super
hot and happening. And it was just kind of a really cool vibe place to be.
Did you let it be known that this is what you wanted?
Oh yeah.
So like, were you like, was that part of like, take us through somebody who's in your position where you give a restaurant group 4 years, right? I mean, I'm noticing a pattern right now that if you don't give people an opportunity, they'll find it somewhere else.
Yeah.
Right? So it's on one side as the restaurateur, you have to provide the opportunity, but on the other side, as the working chef, you also have to, I think, communicate your intentions and your desires.
Right.
Like, what do you want? Like, where are you going? Like, what do you, like, I want to learn, like, my passion's Southeast Asia, you know? So talk us through that balance of like doing your job and also kind of, you know, taking the bull by the horns and influencing your future and being kind of, I guess, like aggressive about what you want in return for your time.
Yeah, I think it's it was something I had to get better at vocally, just because there were so many people in the company, and you know, there's 1,000 employees in that company, and how do you how do you make yourself stand out? But yeah, I think it was always talking to you know, just to backtrack a little, but it was, you know, I had seen during my interview with Kevin was already talking about opening an Asian restaurant, or he had blueprints or something out and was going through this stuff. So I was like, okay, this would be worth it to just put in the time here. And
so he saw what was coming.
Yeah, I saw what was coming. And I said, if there's that, you know, I think very early on, I said, if there's ever an opportunity at the Asian place, I just got out of Thailand.
Yeah.
That's where I want to be.
Chomping at the bit.
Yeah. So I learned to be vocal about, you know, you got to fight for yourself in this business. You got to fight for your raises. You got to fight for your, your promotions, usually, unless you get a surprise one, which is usually how it happens in this business, because somebody gets drunk and doesn't show up, and then all of a sudden you got a sous chef job or whatever it is. Unfortunately, that's kind of how things usually play out.
How do you? What's your advice for fighting for your position and for what you want? Like, how do you approach that?
I think I, well, back then I would just be like, hey, can you?
speak
but big me now would probably say, hey, why don't you just like ask them for a closed door conversation and get your case together a little bit better? You know, like, I know you want more money, but what are you going to bring to the company? You know, tell them what you're going to bring to the company. You're going to do X, Y, and Z, or ask them what you need to do for the company to get that raise.
That's a great advice.
Yeah.
You know, like what, find out, first seek to understand, then seek to be understood. How can you leverage what they need, what they want, and work with the grain? And like, having that information will probably, you know, when you have that data, why not reverse engineer it? Right.
Right.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So, okay. So what's going on? So 2004, 2011, you also opened your first restaurant in 2011, April. So November to February, November 2004 to February 2011, you're the executive chef at Blue Point. Mm-hmm. So April 2011, you're the owner of Seed Kitchen and Bar. So only 3 months go by before becoming. So were you working on kitchen, like Seed Kitchen, while, like, take us through that 3 month transition. Yeah.
I basically had a year off, so I don't know what my resume is saying these days, but or I can't remember what it says. I basically had a year. So you have to remember 2008 happened,
right?
Which was, we were in a building that was a lot of it was like Merrill Lynch and all these giant banks, and all of that lunch business like evacuated. So with the economic crisis that was happening, so. So it was kind of like the writing was on the wall. Like, I knew I needed to change, and this restaurant might be changing because there's nobody in this building anymore.
Right.
I wasn't actively working on it. I always have been thinking about going to my laptop and putting in this concept or that concept or whatever. Probably about 6 months before I left, I just said something clicked. And I think it was me driving by this shopping center, and I saw Whole Foods is coming, and I was like, man, I live in this neighborhood. Like, I've lived in East Cobb for 20 some years now and always commuted to Buckhead, and I saw the Whole Foods sign, and I was like, man, that is
gonna bring business.
That is my clientele.
Yeah.
Like, I could actually put, I never saw like a Seed restaurant in this area until I was like, oh, Whole Foods, okay, well, they're serious. And it's an affluent community, great schools up here, like, people, this is a great suburb, but I never kind of put the two together until I saw that happen. And I was like, I literally called that number on the sign, and I was like, how do we do this? How do I?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you ever wish you could go back 13 years and the traffic wasn't so bad up here?
Yeah. That'd be nice.
It took me 36 minutes to drive up from Atlanta, and I think 15 of that was sitting on the street.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But it's good. It shows the people are here and the opportunities here.
Oh yeah.
You know, this
they
area
keep
is,
coming.
This area is growing like crazy right now. So when did you start living intentionally to make Seed happen?
Yeah. I would say probably about a year and a half to 2 years before we opened our doors. Just really 100% putting in time, writing out a business plan. Like I said, I try to be very organized, and I'm not going to just walk in. My biggest obstacle was the financial part of it. Like, how does a chef like myself get his own place? And I think if I had been educated on that earlier, I probably would have made that leap earlier. But it wasn't as difficult as I made it out to be in my head.
Right.
To get business loans, and, you know, with a steady job history and a few bucks in the bank, you can, you know, a bank will sign on to you. The right bank will sign on to you.
Well, I think you did a lot right by tying your name as executive chef to the Buckhead Life Group, restaurant group. Like, that's one of the best ways to create value in yourself to get a loan. A bank wants to see that you have longevity working with a successful restaurant group. They want to, they're making a gamble on you, essentially.
Yeah, they're hedging their bets, right?
Yeah. So by having that experience, like, you're doing the best thing you can do is getting, having experience.
Yeah.
Right. So what was the mystery for you? Like just the process of going to get the money, like how hard is it to get a loan? Like, what do I need to do beforehand? Like really dive into like, what were you feeling? Like dive into like that point.
Yeah. So, at the time my wife and I both had careers. I mean, we both had some savings, but nothing substantial. We had a kid in private school and that was draining, you know, like our money was, we were doing well, but it was like, you kind of live what you earn. Well, at the time I did. And, we were just kind of getting through everything, but yeah, that was it. It was like, I don't have $1 million in the bank. How am I going to get this thing open? And I actually ended up hooking up with, the Small Business Association. It's actually called the SBDC, Small Business Development Center, up in Kennesaw here, and really got serious about a business plan. And they kind of helped me put together, you know, they were like, you're going to write this business plan and then you got to do all your financial statements and those numbers got to match. And I had no idea about any of this stuff, but they helped me put all that together. So basically free, taxpayer paid. Thank you very much. But they were awesome people that kind of helped me put the package together for the bank, which I would have had no clue. If you're not intentional about, I'm going to go do this, then, you know, it's difficult. But it just turned out to be a little bit easier, and I probably could have done it a few years earlier.
Yeah, it's amazing in our head what we do when we just put things like what fear, like the narrative in our head. Mm-hmm. We overthink it. The amount of overthinking we do ends up being more work than actually just doing the thing.
Right.
Just yeah. Start doing the thing.
Guilty.
And, yeah, me too. You know, like yeah. I think to a level we're all that guilty, but you have to tell that inner voice to shut the F up.
Yeah.
Like shut up. The boss is here. I'm making this decision. We're moving forward. And just have faith that if you keep showing up and you keep trying to be better every day, you figure it out. Eventually you figure it out.
Yeah. And you're going to get doors slammed in your face and you're going to get a bunch of no's. I mean, I got probably 20 no's from banks because this was 2009, 2010. I'm sniffing around for money and they're like,
yeah,
are you paying attention? Doing this. And, you know, but finally I tried the investor route too, cause I was like, I don't have money. I get some investors to put up some money and I'll pay them back, whatever. But, that they were just like locked down no's. So I was like, okay. But then you know, the SBA kind of helped me get through to some banks that kind of understood the restaurant business and understood the risks associated with it. It was also a very good time as far as value is concerned from a construction standpoint.
Because there was nothing being
done. Nobody was working. I mean,
best deals.
You could not do this place for
right
anywhere close to what we did it for back then.
Are you comfortable talking about numbers?
Sure.
What did it cost back then?
I think the construction was about $450,000.
$450,000.
Yeah.
What do you think it would cost today, like $2 million?
yeah. I mean, I tried to do one a couple years later or a few years later when we opened our seafood concept, and that was well over $2 million.
Wow.
Yeah. So wow. About the same size.
Yeah. So when you were going to the banks, were you just taking no or were you kind of like asking why? Why no?
Yeah. Absolutely. We asked. I mean, we got real close with one local bank and we got to the table to sign the papers and they were like, you know what? We thought about it. We're not going to do this. So I'm you just got to keep getting back up and talking to the next person because somebody will say yes. So.
But did they give you a reason why they weren't going to do it? Was there something missing in your plan or was there something they wanted to see? One piece of advice I've gotten is every time you go to a bank and you get no, ask why.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then fix that problem.
Yeah.
And eventually just take away the no's. Like, and eventually you'll find somebody.
I can't remember the exact reason. I mean, it was 14 years ago, but,
right.
But, yeah, it wasn't anything in our plan. Our plan was rock solid. And since that day, I've seen the banker. He comes in here. He's like, sorry, man, I made a big mistake. So it was kind of rewarding.
Right. Yeah. One more quick break to thank our sponsors. When we come back, we're going to talk about you get the money and you finally open. This episode made possible by Owner.com. Owner.com is the quickest and easiest way for your customers to order directly from you without the expensive 30% commission fees. Look.
With Owner.com, you'll save thousands every month when customers order through your website and branded app instead of third-party delivery apps. And reward your customers with a built-in loyalty program that turns them into regulars who order again and again. Owner.com also helps you rank higher on Google with world-class search engine optimization built specifically for restaurants with an AI-powered website. We cannot forget lists. Build a huge list of people who live near your restaurant fast and market to that list on autopilot with text and email sent at the perfect time to help you grow sales and stay top of mind. Owner.com gives you everything you need to grow and market your restaurant online with no contracts or hidden fees. Visit Owner.com/unstoppable right now to book your free demo and see why thousands of restaurant owners trust Owner.com to power their restaurants online. This podcast is made possible by Restaurant Systems Pro, and we need to let you know that every second and fourth Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, CEO of Restaurant Systems Pro, Fred Langley, will be going live where he'll cover what you need to know about running a profitable restaurant from soup to nuts. This live event will reveal the steps to manage the service and financial goals for your restaurant's productivity. Everyone who attends this live event will get a recording of the Restaurant Systems Pro 4-day How to Run a Profitable Restaurant from Soup to Nuts recording. This event costs $2,500 to attend live, and you'll get it for free. Head to go.restaurantsystemspro.net/restaurantunstoppable. That's go.restaurantsystemspro.net/restaurantunstoppable. We're back, and so when did you get a yes? Take us to the yes, when you finally got the yes. What was different about this?
This was a bank that kind of understood the area. They weren't a local bank, but they were. They understood the East Cobb market a little bit better than the other banks, and they understood my background. That was like a major driving point for them because they were familiar with my work.
Right.
You know, maybe the other banks had never heard of Doug Turbush, but these banks were like, yeah, we go to Blue Point. Yeah, we go to Nava, you know, the restaurants I was working in. So I think they understood their customer and they understood the market a lot better than kind of the other banks I was talking to. So,
got it.
And we, I should say, it wasn't by choice that I was 100% owner of this restaurant. It was just, you know, the economy at the time, there was investors weren't biting.
Right.
But that really
kind of worked out.
kind of worked out well to just, I couldn't see doing it any other way.
So what were your biggest struggles over that year of getting open in terms of, like, you know, we identified just finding the money.
Yeah.
Right. But once you got the money, were you like, oh, shit, that was the easy part. Like, now I got to actually deliver on like my vision and my yeah. plan. Like, what was the challenge with that?
Multifaceted. I think, you know, staff is always, even back then, it was like, where am I going to get qualified cooks up here? I'm in the burbs. You know, at the time, there wasn't a lot of restaurants other than every chain you can possibly imagine. So what was going to be my talent pool? Because in Buckheads, it's different. You just, you know, somebody knows somebody that can replace the guy that's on fry tomorrow. And it's kind of a quicker, at the time, it was a quicker find. But yeah, so staffing was kind of my biggest worry. I had some key people I knew I wanted on my team. That's kind of that's the hardest part, is really just who's going to help you carry this vision to fruition, who's behind you, who's got it. And, you know, it was a small pool of people that I had worked with that I loved, that I loved to work with. And so that was helpful. But, yeah, even from day one, these kids are well-to-do up here. They don't necessarily need to work in a restaurant unless they've kind of got the bug for it or a passion for it. So that's kind of always been our challenge up here, is we're training from scratch up here.
Yeah. So one of the thoughts I had earlier when you were talking about having tenure at a restaurant that is a local restaurant group, Buckhead Restaurant Group.
Yeah.
Buckhead Life Restaurant yeah. Group. Is you get deep network. How many people did you, in your 11 years there, did yeah. you get to like work with, to find out who's who the good workers are? Like, you get to bring an army with you when you do that.
Yeah.
And I think that is probably the most underrated thing that you get when you spend tenure at one spot, is you just know everybody.
Yeah.
You know, you get to create the opportunity for the people that deserve it.
Yeah.
So do you think it would have been harder if you didn't have that 10-year run in the local behind-the-scenes restaurant community?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, not just within Buckhead Life itself, but you're going out to check out the latest restaurants with other chefs. You're meeting other chefs in the whole Buckhead area at the time. And, that network was kind of invaluable in trying to find who I wanted on this team to get things going.
The first struggle was finding the people. How do you overcome it?
A lot of interviewing, because really it was just hundreds of interviews down at the what used to be a Caribou Coffee down the street. Just trying to get narrow it down and figure out who could actually deliver kind of that in-town dining experience and bring it out here to the suburbs, because this was sort of a unique proposition at the time. It's pretty common now. You've got the bigger shopping centers in the burbs, but there wasn't a whole lot of chefs out here in the suburbs. If you were a serious chef with accolades, you wanted to be in Buckhead, you wanted to be in Atlanta proper, and cooking at the best restaurants. This was kind of a... There's a few pioneering chefs at the time that kind of branched out, and I've kind of followed that, and I was like, this is 5 minutes from my house. Like, it's not...
I think there's something to be said about developing an eye for neighborhoods on the come up.
Yeah.
And it's generally like right on the periphery, like the peripheral, like right on the edge.
Right.
Like wherever, like if you can, like I'm thinking of like East Texas right now, or East Austin, sorry. Like that, you wouldn't have gone there 15 years ago. You would not have opened a restaurant there. But cities grow from the inside out. And eventually what's on the outside becomes on the inside real fast. And I think that's probably safe to say with Atlanta, especially post-2020, with all the people that came down here after the pandemic. Has there been a surge in business since the pandemic? You'd think. No?
Since the pandemic? Yeah, I mean, we went through the surge that everyone felt right after that. But yeah, I mean, now we're hitting better numbers than we did prior. So, but I think, you know, part of that's obviously price driven too.
Right. Yeah. So going back to 2011, you opened your first restaurant. What was the next struggle?
The next struggle.
Or the biggest thing, like just reflecting back, what gave you the most anxiety?
People.
What do you mean? Like customers, guests, all people?
Mainly employees. It was a lot of turnover. It was a lot of like, this is just not working out for that person. I guess I was a little bit more used to longevity in employees, and really we kind of filtered through a lot of that.
Were people quitting or getting fired?
Mainly not showing up, and that would drive it. So whatever, it just wasn't a good fit for them, I think. But at the end of the day, people are. That's what keeps you up at night, whether it's your staff or the guest or the...
Was there a tipping point where that stopped happening as often?
Yeah, I mean, we got our groove pretty quickly. And I think we got a hold of the neighborhood. Like, we started seeing regulars, like, pretty early on. So
how long did that take?
We were busy from day one, and I don't kid about that. It was like... I was like, this is too much. Like, what are we doing?
So what was the vision? Yeah. Like, what did you create in Seed Kitchen and Bar?
Me and my, I used to joke with my chef de cuisine here at the time and be like, I always say, I just want a small little bistro in the suburbs. You know, that's all I want. And then it kind of turned into, you know, this is, at the end of the day, this is a 220 seat restaurant. It's a monster, you know, when it wants to be. So, I think that monster just came out a little early and we were like, all right, we're back to doing big numbers again, so this isn't going to be that quaint. But that's good. That's business. So,
did you kind of feed your curiosity with was it Blue Point? What was the name of the restaurant? Yeah. So that did that wave of Southeast Asian kind of come and go?
So, I mean, Asian fusion at the time, which it was, has kind of run its course, but... you know, you can't deny that influence. It's still here in my food here because, you know, they're great flavors and you can't deny them. So you'll see, like our signature cod dish has, you know, it's got this side on it of caramelized Brussels sprouts and cauliflower. And we do a little nuoc cham sort of vinaigrette on there, kind of just pulling in some of those flavors. And it's, it's awesome.
That sounds great, man. Yeah. So looking back, so let's go 30,000 feet real quick.
Yeah.
2011, you opened your first restaurant. We talked about some of those challenges and how you overcame them.
Yeah.
the next restaurant you opened was 2013.
Yep.
That was
Stem Wine Bar.
Stem Wine Bar, right next door.
Right next door. Yep.
And then 2016, you opened your third concept.
Yeah.
Which was
Drift Fish House and Oyster Bar.
And that closed recently.
Yeah, closed in January.
January of this year.
Yeah.
2 months ago.
Yeah.
So let's so where were you in 2013 where you felt like you were ready to expand? What was going on?
Yeah, we were Seed was jamming every night. We had people on wait. We had people we'd watch them walk up to the restaurant up the parking lot here, and we'd be like, "Man, couldn't we do something?" And we were actually storing some of our kitchen equipment next door and some of our extra plates and silverware at this little space that was next door that the landlord hadn't booked yet out of the redevelopment they did here. And I just got this. We were like, what could we put there that would make sense? Where, you know, maybe we could put some overflow over there, whatever. And we were like, oh, wine bar sounds good. Okay.
Right. It's smart. Oh, you're waiting for a seat. Well, go next door and have a glass of wine. It's perfect.
Right. So that was kind of the original intent of it. And then really it kind of morphed into its own concept. It's got its own clientele. It's got everything's its own menu. People go there to go to Stem, not to go to Seed. And then if they're waiting, they go to Stem. But
got it.
It's definitely got its own.
So originally, was it crowd. Just a place? Was it just an extension of Seed, or was it its own thing originally?
Yeah, it was. It was very much its own thing. Okay. I mean, that was intention.
Same kitchen?
What's that?
Same kitchen?
No, we got a little one person kitchen back there. That can,
different LLC?
No, same. Yeah.
Okay.
But we kind of. It was intentional to kind of make the wines a little bit more esoteric over there, and, you know, kind of get that wine connoisseur in the neighborhood that's got the collection in the basement, like give them a place to go and share. And then, yeah, really it was just kind of make it a nice bar, make its own menu, sort of a lot of, you know, small plates, no real big entrees, nothing like that. But, and then I guess it was about a year, maybe two into it, that we kind of got the idea of we should be doing like serious sit-down wine tastings and wine dinners. And
why is that the way to go? Why should this be what you're doing?
Right. I guess it was, you know, we learned from this, our clientele is that they value experiences, right? So whether that experience is a wine dinner or a pop-up or a, you know, a just doing a wine tasting or wine tasting paired with food or a beer dinner, they really, like, those sell out so quickly. So that's where we were like, there's something to this. Let's see if we can come up with a regular event. And, you know, a wine bar on Tuesday night in the suburbs of Atlanta is not automatically packed, okay? So it was also learning the business of how do I make it full on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday nights, right?
What did you learn that you can pay forward to people who are struggling filling their restaurants on these days?
Yeah, so it's create an experience that is undeniable that's going to get them off their couch.
Paint the picture of the experience you created.
Okay. So we talked to our distributors. They had seen something similar in some other wine bars, and they were like, you should do like five or six wines, and we can do it for like $20, and they'll taste a bunch of different wines. And I was like, well, I'm a chef. I'm going to put food with these things. Right. So we ended up creating what was six courses, six bites of food. And that we go to a different wine region every month. So we'll go to North Italy. We'll go to whatever wine region it is. We just got off of Napa. And we'll kind of create a menu around that Napa-driven food or that Piedmont-driven food of Italy or whatever it is. We'll make sure all those wines are from that region and all the food kind of makes sense.
Yeah, so you're giving them a tour and never leaving Atlanta.
Right, you don't have to leave the burbs here. Yeah, you're good. So,
and you're charging $20 for a ticket?
No, originally it was $20 just for the wine, and then we morphed into food. So now I think they're up to $55 a head.
So would you sell like an event, or would they how would the reservations work with that?
We always do tickets.
Tickets, and what were you using to sell those tickets? Is it the same today as it was then?
I think so. We used Eventbrite. Yeah.
Eventbrite.
Yeah.
So you just go on Eventbrite, you create an event, and you max out how many people? 20 people per event?
It's 24. Yeah.
24.
Yeah.
And you have a fixed rate and a fixed menu.
Yep.
Any more detail necessary in terms of like setting that up?
No, I mean we do a lot of things. We give them a map of the whole region. I've got an advanced sommelier that kind of helps me run the whole thing, and he's kind of like their encyclopedia of wine. So yeah. There's got to be that. We enlisted the help of the suppliers too. So there's got to be some knowledge and entertainment thing happening. So
can you paint the picture of what that looks like? So because I like to say that. The restaurant owner's job is to paint the picture of perfection for the staff. Like yep. Your job is to show them how everything that they're responsible mm-hmm. for is supposed to be done. You show them how to do it. Where does the restaurant owner to get that? So I want you to paint the picture for people at home listening to this. Like, what is it done look right? Like, what is that? Like, what does that experience look like?
Sure. Yeah. You'll walk in with your partner or your buddy, and you're going to sit down, and you're going to be greeted at the table with a map of the region, and you're going to be friendly greeted by our staff, obviously, and you're going to begin with two courses, and we're going to have the sommelier come out, or the wine distributor, probably somewhat educated in wine at least, and they'll explain kind of the background, the history of this wine, where it came from, and then chef's going to come out and explain his two courses, and then that's on repeat two times. You're having a great time. You're having interactions with not only your bartender, but a sommelier and the chef. So at some point during the night, you're going to have a one-on-one connection with one of those people. So I think that's part of the experience, and building regulars is like building those relationships. And, oh, yeah, I know Clint in the kitchen. Yeah, I love Brian in the front. That really is kind of what made that, I mean, that wine tasting experience, that'll sell out before that month begins. Right. So
I mean, I would argue that you're in the experience economy 100%.
Yeah.
Education is an experience. Mm-hmm. When you're and that's one of the best angles to play in the restaurant industry. It's not just feeding people, but educating them on the history of that play and the evolution of that play and helping them understand how to pair food and wine. All these things are educational.
Yeah.
You're teaching about the history of that place it came from, but I think you're also in the transformation economy. So I just recently had Joe Pine on the show, the author mm-hmm. of The Experience Economy.
Yeah.
And during that conversation, he suggested that we are going away from the experience economy and entering the transformation economy. Mm-hmm. So any ideas of what I mean by transformation economy?
No.
So it's this idea of taking people, your target market, and transforming them into a new rendition of themselves. Mm-hmm. So in a way, you are taking these people who might not know a lot about wine, but every week there's a new wine event with a new education. And they're going from not being that experienced about wine in that area to, if they show up every week, they're educating themselves. Right. They're becoming connoisseurs. They can have conversations with people. You're educating them. You're making them better versions of themselves in a specific vertical area of expertise.
Yeah, and I think that was intentional from the beginning. Was I didn't want, because like, to be honest, I didn't know a whole lot about wine when I opened a wine bar. I mean, I got my CSW, and
but you don't have to. You know somebody else who does.
Right. I did, but I probably didn't know as much as I should have, but I think it was more about I didn't want to have a super pretentious wine bar, because I wanted people to feel welcomed, and I wanted them to feel like it's okay that I'm a novice, and if I never learn anything about wine, at least I had a great time and I had great food.
Yeah.
So.
So you they walk in. There's a map of the area. There's a seven course. You said seven.
Six
wine?
Course.
Yeah. Six course.
Yep.
How many different wines will be paired?
Six wines.
Six wines.
Yep.
And it's just a bite. So is it like a small pour and a bite?
Yep, small pour and a bite. It's at the end of the meal. It's a meal.
Yeah, so, yeah. Got you. And there, it's just people just sharing information, and really it's an educational experience.
Yeah.
Wow, you sell out of these? You said.
Yeah, they sell out every month before the month begins.
So, okay. So, you, how often do you? Like, how far out are you? Like, in terms of like planning, I guess is what I'm curious about.
Planning for we plan the year. Like, we'll pick the regions in December at our kind of management meeting, and we'll map that out. Sometimes that'll change, but yeah, we'll figure out what's going to be good and go from there.
And earlier you alluded to the point of like learning how to do this to actually drive traffic. So at first, was it like gangbusters out of the gates? Were you selling out?
Yeah, it was pretty early. Fortunately, it was pretty early start that we were like, oh my gosh, we actually kind of modified it.
We used to fill all 36 seats over there and then just realized that kind of got away from us and they weren't having the experience we wanted. So we pared it down to about 24 people, which works real well. Two groups of 12.
Yeah. Has the price gone up as demand has gone up?
I would say not fast enough, but recently out of necessity, it's had to go up.
So, yeah. Well, yeah. The cost of goods have gone up.
Yeah.
But I would say like, you know, demand determines value too. Like if you're selling out, then start bumping it up slowly to the point where you find that sweet spot where you're making an extra. I mean, you don't want to be greedy about it, but at the same time, like if it's selling, like get the most you can, squeeze the lemon, you know?
Right. And I think that's, you know, that's one of the things Fred's group, you know, Restaurant Systems Pro has kind of helped me with, because we weren't charging enough for what we were delivering. I mean, we bring in all these people, we've got knowledgeable people on staff. And
when did they come into the picture?
2015, I want to say.
I was actually leading into that. I was going to ask. So, like, after 2013, you have two concepts. Both you're selling out. You're full. Mm-hmm. You're making money. What was the best year in terms of profitability for you, or percent profit?
It was pretty early. I want to say 2015.
2015.
Yeah.
Are you comfortable talking about like volume and stuff like that?
Sure.
So, what were you doing in terms of revenue?
Between these two concepts, right around $4 million.
$4 million.
Yeah.
And what point are you saying, like, what's wrong where you feel like you need to go out and get outside help? Were you not making the percent profit you think you could have?
I was in the red.
Really?
Yeah.
With $4 million in revenue.
Yeah.
Holy moly.
Not every month, but I mean.
Was it just the not like the during the valleys you just
weren't?
Okay.
I didn't understand. I mean, I kind of understood, but.
Sorry, I didn't mean to sound like a jerk when I said holy.
No. It's like I said, I didn't know a whole lot going into this. I mean, Buckhead Life was a giant $60 million restaurant company, and I had no idea what was happening on the P&L.
Again, so, like you painted the picture for the experience economy thing, right? Like paint the picture of what you didn't know.
Right.
Like knowing what you know now, reflecting back who you were in 2014.
Yeah.
Paint a picture of just the things you're just like now knowing what you know, just like you kind of make you chuckle at that what you didn't know.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know much beyond an Excel spreadsheet.
Okay.
So getting into things like menu engineering was foreign, like taking a look at what's selling, what's not selling, making, you know, pricing adjustments based on popularity dishes, things like that was just like not on my radar.
What about menu cards?
What's that?
What about menu cards?
Cards?
Like recipe cards.
It was a Word document. Yeah. But, you know, getting into a database system like Restaurant Systems Pro was like super helpful in that, like it's all in one place. And now the pieces of the puzzle kind of came together. I knew bits and pieces, but that's kind of really what those types of software kind of can do for you.
So what is exactly is it doing? Is it pulling it all together? Like how does it like get further into what it will do for you?
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess it starts with the basics of, you know, doing a regular inventory, right?
How often were you doing inventory before?
Monthly.
And how often do you do it now?
Weekly.
Okay.
Yeah.
How does that help?
Every week, I've got a management meeting where my managers can now tell me, instead of me telling them, how they performed at their job every single week, which is a game changer.
And that's because of inventory?
That's because of weekly inventory.
Okay.
Yep.
So basically you can see, like dive deeper into how this enables them to do that.
Okay. So we've got basically a scorecard we put together and, you know, beverage guy's got his accountabilities, which are, you know, wine cost, liquor cost, NA beverage, et cetera. On that scorecard every week is his target percentage and his actual percentage, right? And if he's in the green, he's either in the green or he's in the red. If he's in the red, he's got to, don't come to that meeting empty-handed. Come to that meeting with, oh yeah, not excuses either, but I had to make extra purchases. Wine tastings just started. I overbought for X, Y, and Z. This should self-correct in the next week or two. Like he's got a reason. He or she has a reason on what's going to happen.
If you're in the red, you have to become a little bit of a detective and figure out what happened. Where did this go?
Yeah. Absolutely. Same thing with food and controllables and comps and everything else we have on that scorecard. And that's where, you know, that inventory is just super important, super helpful.
So what gets met, what was it? What gets tracked or what gets managed, gets minded? What gets,
what gets,
What is it? What gets measured gets improved.
Yeah, something like that. But you don't know. You have to keep score. You have to know the game of business has a scorecard. If you're playing the game, you got to know how you're scoring the game. Are we winning or are we losing? Right. Yeah. And the only competitor is you yesterday. Like you're trying to get better and better and better. And the cool thing is when you bring your team into it, you're bringing them into the game of business. Now it's a group event. Right. How can we get better? How can we beat that version of ourselves last year?
Yeah.
You know, and like every, like you just, but what happens when you bring people in and they, you force them to get the magnifying glass out and go find where the points went.
Right.
What happens?
They're, you know, they get passionate about it. They get, you know, they understand the accountability. It helps them grow as a leader.
Do they get better?
They get better.
Do they do those things again? Likely, it probably happens more.
Well, if they do, they don't stick around much longer.
Right. But like the point is, like you start teaching, they start learning. And like the cracks get smaller.
Yeah.
Right. And eventually it's success by 1,000 cuts. Because all these things compound and you just get better and better and better. So you mentioned early on it was inventory. It was costing cards and menu engineering. How did you discover Restaurant Systems Pro?
I had gone to a Cisco demo of sorts of products and whatnot. And David Scott Peters was there at the time giving his restaurant or Smart Systems Pro at the time. Kind of little speech, and he had this 3-day workshop out in Arizona, and that sounded really intriguing to me because he's an amazing speaker, but he's
so good.
But he's also very genuinely knowledgeable of how business works,
right?
And things that were just like light bulbs were going off left and right, and I was like, I'm going to Arizona. I don't know what this guy is. I don't know if he's a shyster selling me snake oil, but this sounds like I need this, and I did that. Ended up doing that. Signed up pretty quickly after that and just got into it, dug into that system.
He really is a great speaker. I saw him go live a couple of days ago, and he's just so polished the way that he delivers.
Yeah.
And I think I've just recently started going live regularly in Facebook, and like I get started, and I'm like, I don't know what I'm going to talk about today. I'm like, I'm supposed to go live, and I just like start making things up. But he definitely is inspiring, his ability to communicate and to deliver. So you go to this 3-day event. What happens at the end of it? This is 2000 when?
Probably 15.
15? That's right. You said that earlier.
Yeah. So it was, you know, you're going through 3 days of just like, again, light bulb after light bulb. I met Fred, you know, he was chef background. So that kind of resonated with me. And it's like, these guys know what they're talking about. And if I can get some of these numbers in line, like this could be, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars a year if we can figure this stuff out. And that's really where, once I put in the work, you know, did all the cards, which is just hours and hours of work and inventory.
There's nothing easy about being a successful restaurant owner. There's work involved. There's no secret.
Yeah. But there's no, but what it does, it takes away the mystery of why am I losing money or why am I not making what I should be making.
And you don't have to do it alone. You can pull it, to your point, you can pull your team on this. Like you can, they're giving you a smart system.
Right.
You're learning it and then you're delegating it. You know, it doesn't have to be all on your shoulders, but there needs to be guidelines. There needs to be a way to do it so that it can be replicated.
Yeah, and to their credit, there's to my knowledge, there's no other software where you're going to get the support system you have with them. And that's huge. To get the buy-in of your management team and the rest of your team, like if they know they can pick up the phone and just talk to Brittany or talk to whoever's online this and get like valuable help, you don't have that buy-in, and that's where they're kind of making the difference.
So knowing that there's a support system waiting for them,
your
team helps buy in. How else did you get buy-in? Because this is where I think a lot of people struggle with implementing this level of system. It's a lot of work. It's intimidating.
Yeah. Yeah, like weekly inventory is like the bane of existence for every manager in hospitality. But then to tell them, well, we're going to start doing it every week now.
Right.
I mean, that's probably the hardest sell, and I was the most hesitant in pulling that trigger because I was like, I don't want to do that either. But
how did you sell it?
I just kind of told him, like, it's amazing, kind of what I said before. It's amazing, like, these teams that have been running on this system for years, like, they know exactly where they are every week, and if there's a trend, like, they're in the red for 3 or 4 weeks in a row, like, they can go attack that problem. you let 3 or 4 months go by, you're losing tens of thousands of dollars. Right. And that's kind of where they kind of clicked.
Yeah. 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 There's no period of things to get away. There's no time for things to get away from you because instantly you're catching it.
Yeah.
So after, when in 2015, where was Smart Systems Pro then? What was it? It wasn't software, was it?
Yeah, it was software.
Was it software at this point? Okay.
It was mainly software. I didn't know about the mastermind stuff and all that. Just kind of basic. I need basic, you know, inventory software is what I needed.
Got it. Post initial onboarding with Restaurant Systems Pro, like once you start implementing all the systems, are you using every element of Restaurant Systems Pro today? Are you fully in, or just inventory management, costing cards, like menu engineering?
I'm more into it now than we were. It took me a long time to get into labor. We just actually did this. It took me this last year to get there.
Was it worth it?
Yeah, I think the insight has been very helpful. So we use some of the other leading software for labor, like Seven Shifts and Hot Schedules and that sort of thing. And they're very user friendly software, and they're super good stuff. But number wise, weren't giving me exactly to the penny what I needed to kind of track labor, which is what you have to do these days.
What were you missing?
So those systems inherently, Restaurant Systems Pro bases most of your numbers off of gross sales. Either one of those systems couldn't figure that out, how to not do it off of net sales after pushing and prying and can you please change this? And I think that's having it all under one roof and you're all praying at the same number every week. I mean, it's just been kind of a game changer as far as...
We get the theoretical, right? Is that what you were missing before with being able to get access to your theoretical costs?
With food?
You have your actual and your theoretical.
Yeah.
Were you missing that when you weren't implementing the labor element of it?
Right. We weren't... we were just kind of working off numbers that their AI had generated our forecast of versus like really kind of thinking about what our forecast is going to be next week, which is, it's a much more manual system. I'll say that as far as tracking your labor, but it also gives your manager going to spend more time on like digging into the history of what we did last year and where are we going this year and what's happening in town this week and that sort of stuff. But it's been helpful. It's more work like anything else with them, but it's
well, it's, I mean, I think better, it's numbers. Yeah. You know, it's the way that I explain it. It's like, listen, the way I see Restaurant Systems Pro is it's a process to keep you honest and to keep you, it's the things you have to do to be successful.
Yeah.
But they paint the picture of the job done right. Look what it looks like.
Yeah.
And if you want to get the numbers, if you want to be successful, it's, these things are rituals. They're things you have to do every day. They're rituals and they're routines. And guess what? That is all culture. It's not just what you put on paper and what you believe and what your values are. It's the things you do every day. And when you have a whole like system, like you think about the United States government, right? Mm-hmm. I remember being a kid, woke up, I got dressed, I brushed my teeth, had a little snack or maybe snack and then breakfast, then brush your teeth. You go, you do the Pledge of Allegiance. Mm-hmm. You have a cubby for your backpack. Every day was exactly the same. At first it's this, then it's that, then it's this. That's culture. It's the things you do. Like, and they're cranking out employees, right? But like everything needs repetition and routine. There's steps you have to go through and everybody has to go through it. And it's, you can't just say that you're going to be the best. You have to put things in motion to be the best. And it's hard. There's no shortcut.
No.
But this is a guide wider through the obstacle is what I like to say.
Yeah, and I'd go to, you know, when I went to my first mastermind, I'm like, well, this guy's got 6 restaurants. He's doing everything. Like, well, who am I to say that this doesn't work, right? You know?
So. Yeah. And it, the thing is, like anything else, it's like once you start doing it, it's just normal. It's like going to the gym.
Yeah.
Going to the gym sucks.
Right.
I'm trying to be better about it on the road.
Right.
And like the resistance of just like actually making it happen, I just need to like start using my Planet Fitness card and going. Yeah. But what, like anything else, you start doing it and then it's like, oh, it's time to go to the gym and you just start doing it. And before you know it, it's just a part, it's just routine, it's habit. And it just happens. Yeah. It only sucks it probably sucked more in the beginning, right?
Yeah.
Going to the gym 5 years later still sucks, but it sucks less.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So anyway, I don't mean to spend so much time talking about Restaurant Assistance Pro, but I am curious. What about now that you're using all these like these different systems, you said that you're in the red with $4 million revenue. Mm-hmm. Are you still doing those numbers, $4
million? Oh, yeah.
Are you percent profit?
Then or now?
Now.
Yeah, we're in double digits.
Double digits.
Yeah.
So that's awesome. Yeah, congratulations.
It's good.
So was it worth it?
I mean, is
double digits profit on $2 million or $4 million annual revenue worth it?
Yeah, it's totally worth it. I mean, it was. I thank those guys every time I see them. I'm like, you guys changed my business. I mean, it could have been so many restaurants just are in that 3-6% range where it's like, this is so hard. This business is so hard. There's so many headaches every day. We all are here working our butts off. And you walk out of here with 3%, it is just like so demoralizing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll throw out an approximate number, right?
Yeah.
$600,000 a year sounds like a good amount of money to go through some extra steps.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know?
And yeah. That's what's on the table when you're willing to do the work and create routine and ritual and habit around these things. So 2016, you opened your third concept.
Yeah.
You've mastered the restaurant systems. So now you're an amazing chef. Mm-hmm. You know how to design a restaurant that people love. You have systems. You know how to be profitable now. What's going on in 2016? Like, from 2016 to 2024, so you had an 8-year run.
Yeah, yeah.
So, well, let's just start. Kind of getting a little bit ahead of ourselves.
Yeah.
How was, I don't know why the name of the restaurant
Drift.
Drift. Yeah. Yeah. How was Drift in the beginning? How was it received?
Very well. I kind of had to figure out what was next for the neighborhood. I knew I wanted to stay in the neighborhood. I mean, it's less than a mile from here, and I needed to figure out what I could do successfully, given my background. And I had worked at Blue Point. Blue Point was, I worked under and with Chef Ian Winslade, and he's just an amazing La Bernardin tenured chef, really good guy. He's got a few restaurants in Buckhead now. And, so I knew seafood really well. And I was like, well, there's no, you know, seafood that you can really get in this area that's going to be fresh and flown in every week and three times a week or whatever. And I kind of went with it. I didn't really do any market research. And but I did what I knew, you know? And
in terms of what?
Of like, you know,
costs.
Like even a survey of the market, like what type of food is missing from your neighborhood. Okay. I didn't do any of that. I was just like, I'm going to do me.
I think there's something to be said about that.
Yeah.
I go back and forth on that one.
Yeah.
It depends. What I've learned is there is no right way to open a restaurant.
Yeah.
I mean, there are right ways, but there is no one way. Mm-hmm. It all depends on the person who's doing it, the values of the person to do it. Like, why are you doing it?
Right.
Are you doing it to make as much money as possible? Are you doing it for the passion of the thing?
Yeah.
Like, and all those are variables that you have to take into equation. You know?
I think one of the biggest reasons, you know, I pursued this growth path was you have very talented people that work for you that are like, what's next? When can I become a manager? When can I, first day of the sixth day. Okay. When can I move up, into management? When can I do this or that? And it's like that pressure is on your shoulders and you're like, I need answers. And I almost felt like that was sort of driving my, I didn't necessarily have a passion for opening a seafood restaurant and, but it was like, I gotta, you know, this is my family now. I gotta help these people and get things moving and create opportunities.
Absolutely.
It's, you feel that pressure for sure. And I think, you know, maybe I should slow down a little bit, but the intentions were good for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, any lessons to learn opening your, so you had, this is your third restaurant technically.
Yeah.
But the first one is literally like right next door. So you don't have to find that.
Right.
People get pulled away from the first restaurant when they open their second one. But I feel like because you, in the way that you did that, I meant to draw attention to it, the best way to do it.
Yeah.
Take over the place that's physically right next to you if it's available.
Mm-hmm.
And that slow lateral growth, I think, is the way to do it.
Yeah.
Because you can just slowly scale. But how far away was Drift?
From here?
Yeah.
It's less than a mile. Okay. So I knew I wanted to stay in the East Cobb market. I thought it wasn't quite satiated yet with kind of upscale cuisine. And, you know, we did good business. We did, really good fresh seafood. I was very proud of what we did. We brought, the first raw bar to the neighborhood. We were doing fresh, 6 or 12 different oysters from around the country. It was just like, you don't get that up here, and you can't get that up here anymore. It's just like, but I think, when you talk about product, market, and fit, like, I definitely had the product. I definitely had the market. And then you kind of figure out, is this fitting right? And that's kind of what, we had a great, I always say we had a great first year. And then it was like, all right, how do we, we got to start coming up with some promotions here. So, yeah. But I will tell you, I've learned more about business, about marketing, in a business that was kind of.
Out of necessity.
Because Seed, I don't have to do anything at Seed. I mean, Seed just goes.
It just hits. Yeah.
And that's you're in a very fortunate position if you have a business like
it's
that.
It's very safe. I don't want to call it like safe, like underplaying. I don't mean that to come out the wrong way, but like American Bistro does really great in America for some reason.
Yeah. Imagine that.
They just always seem like, solid burger, solid. I haven't really gotten a look. But I've seen food walking by the window. I don't know exactly what's going on here.
Yeah.
Just meat and sides, sandwiches, like that stuff just does really well. So what did you learn about marketing? Like how did this experience help you? Like what things did you start doing differently because of this experience?
Yeah, I think, part of it was also how do we create those experiences over there? Like what kind of packages can we put together? We learned what not to do mainly.
What not to do? What is that?
We tried the happy hour thing, like let's bring them in for oyster happy hour and let's build a whole crowd. Well, you're in the suburbs, like they're in their car till 7, and that's why, business hits at 7:30 in the suburbs like it does. But and that can bring in the wrong, not your ideal customer, right? Looking for a cheap drink, looking for what else can I get for cheap over here? It's just like it wasn't. It wasn't necessarily great for, the business. So I think we did some, we did some things during the pandemic that we realized did work. I mean, we had a pop-up called Pop's Lobster Shack. So we turned it into the patio into a New England style lobster shack where you can get lobster rolls and
Connecticut style or Maine style?
We do both.
Okay.
So, but yeah, that was something that was awesome and worked really well, but lots of different ideas. It was just a lot of trial and error because we had to.
Yeah.
So,
what's the best way you grew during this time? Was it just in the marketing?
I think no. It was my role had changed dramatically from I was the chef on the expo here over at Seed every night to now I'm running two chefs, our third chef in the wine bar, and running a management staff of 12, 13 people. That was kind of my biggest transition. Was like, I was a little lost in the beginning, but again,
The struggle?
The struggle was like, that was my comfort zone for 25 years. Yeah. I really love being in the kitchen and I really love, watching the food go out and the excitement and that stuff. And to be the guy that's kind of roaming around and poking in and checking on things. It was foreign to me.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, it was foreign to me, but I think I found my footing in that. I had to put some systems into place just to manage the management, Yeah. But,
what systems did you put in place that weren't there before to manage the management?
EOS. So if you're
if
you're familiar,
Dude, Doug, get out of my head, man. If anybody listens to the show, they know that I'm an EOS junkie. I've actually had Gina Wickman on the show. I've had Mike Payton on the show. These are so you have Traction, right? And then you have the EOS or the Traction Library of Books,
right?
How to Be a Great Boss, Process, Rocket Fuel, dude. I'm a nerd, so sorry for my excitement. Keep going, please.
Yeah. US. So once I had three places, I was just kind of like, how do people do this? And then, I don't know, I got sent a Traction book by some salesman at some point, and I read it cover to cover, and I was just like, I need something like this.
Like what?
Yeah, like something that kind of defines my culture. Something that...
A VTO? A vision traction organizer?
Yeah. How do we... Yeah, VTO. How do we define our culture? How do we organize ourselves? How do we make the most of what we're doing? And how do we get results? And so, that's ultimately what I was trying to figure out.
So what are the biggest things that you pulled from Traction that you implement here?
It was basics. I mean, we had kind of core values that I copied from restaurantowner.com or something. And it was just like, that's what we're going to go with. But then we had to actually kind of go back and think about our culture and think about what makes us different, what makes us stand out. What do we value, right?
Yes. Do you remember the original core values?
Yeah, they're on the wall over there.
Did the ones that you pulled from owner.com?
No, they were very generic.
Okay.
Yeah. But they were, okay, that sounds good. Yeah. You know, it wasn't like, that kind of sounds like us.
So what are they today?
Putting
you on the spot.
You're going to do it, aren't you? we have Do the Right Thing. Reputation is everything. Deliver heartfelt service. Stay hungry. Be humble. Mm. And I probably missed one, but close enough.
So why are those unique to you? How are those unique to you?
Well, I think, you know, we sat down as a management team and really had to had someone kind of facilitate that whole process and kind of pull out, you know, what do we value? And, you know, we kind of looked at what is our ideal team member and what are those attributes? And that's really, that person's going to do the right thing. That person's going to stay hungry. They want to learn more. That person's going to be humble, and, you know, and when you have someone that's not fitting that bill, and usually they're either going to find their way out, or it's just proven to be, you can really hire and fire by your core values.
100%.
Yeah.
It is a filter that you do everything by.
Sure.
It keeps you on course. Same with your vision and your mission. Like if you're trying to make a hard decision, like, well, should we do this or not for our business? Turn around and look at your core values. Oh, right. Shit, we clearly should not do this.
Right.
Does it back up who we say we are? Where we want to be in 5 years? Is this that?
Yeah.
Is this going there? No. The answer is no. If it's not a fuck yeah, it's a hell no.
Right.
Right? Part of my language. Yeah. But it's super important.
I always say if I'm walking around here pissed off, it's because somebody is stepping on the neck of one of my core values.
Yeah.
And that's it.
Yeah. And it makes decision making so much easier. I want to go back. So you helped you clarify your culture, mm-hmm. right? It forced you to go through processes to say, this is who we are.
Yeah.
If you're not this, get the hell out.
Right.
What else?
Scorecard's huge. I think that's something I kind of read about and how Google does business or something, but really just kind of figuring out what are the most important 15 numbers in your business. If you were on a deserted island, you could look at those 15 numbers and understand how your business is doing.
Yeah.
Right.
Jack Sack, The Great Game of Business. I don't know if that was a reference for you, but it's a good place to start if you're interested in doing that.
Yeah.
Are you using the level 10 meeting by any chance?
Every week.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Brother, get into that.
Yeah. So it's called an L10 or a level 10 meeting, which is basically the premise behind it is you walk out of that meeting and you've rated it a 10, right? But it goes through a series of you know, we kind of get into the meeting. We have a little segue. We have just basically a routine of how we run that meeting every single week. The meat of the meeting is what they call IDS or, you know, you could tell me.
Identify, discuss, solve.
Yeah. Identify, discuss, and solve our issues. So getting those issues sometimes is the hardest part, like getting people to actually put something on the list. But once it's on there, we can talk openly and honestly and safely about all these different topics. And that takes time to build, though. I mean, my meetings pre-EOS were a lot of red faces, you know, a lot of anger, a lot of tension. And once we realize they're, you know, if you actually apply this methodology and you make people feel safe about talking about things, then you can actually get a lot accomplished. Right. Yeah.
What you're doing is what Rudy Mick calls creating safe space.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to create an environment where you open the door of communication and you say it's safe to get it out here. But you also have to make sure that it's safe.
Yeah.
So when people do share things, you're not like coming down with a gavel, you know, like you got to like really create that safe space and say, like, I'd rather know that you messed up than get swept under the rug.
Yeah.
And like, And once you make the mistake, that's fine. But like, let's learn from it so we don't make the same mistake. And we won't be able to learn from it unless we are it's being brought to our attention.
Yeah. And, you know, I was raised in the old school. So it was like coming from, you know, your food cost is too high and I'm not just going to yell louder.
Right.
Versus like, how do we actually use our brains to solve this issue?
This is exactly what I mean by inspire, empower, and transform the industry. Mm-hmm. You know, and like we never spoke, we never talked, we never shared information. And it's so crazy, man. And like, I knew you were in Atlanta. I met you twice. And I was telling you on my way down here, like life was so crazy trying to get on the road because I was trying to figure out what it's like to live in a truck camper. I was doing that. And we just relaunched Restaurant Unstoppable Network. We migrated from Mighty Networks to Facebook. We moved our website from WordPress to ClickFunnels.
Yeah.
We are collaborating with Restaurant Assistance Pro beyond our sponsorship because I believe in them that much. I feel like Fred is just in the community over there has just so impressed me. All the conversations I've had, all this is all happening all at once. And I'm driving and I was like, shit, Doug is in Atlanta. I'm going to be in Atlanta in 2 days. I was like, I forgot to reach out. So I'm so happy we did. I didn't know that you used EOS, man.
Religiously.
Yeah. And it's weird. So like, I feel like the timing of this interview is so perfect because, one of the reasons why I'm headed to Arizona, and we would have already, by the time this goes live, I think I'm going to be in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And Fred and I are basically announcing our partnership beyond sponsorship, where if I'm opening a restaurant tomorrow and I'm trying to scale from 0 to 5 restaurants in 5 years or less, who am I going to? And I'm collaborating with them and we're going to coach together. So
awesome.
So I'm actually going, I'm thinking about bringing in Rudy Mick to be like my mentor in the world of culture, because I think he just does culture better than anybody else.
Yeah.
We are so aligned. So, I'm hoping to bring some of Rudy Mick's material in terms of helping my members, our coaching with vision, with core values, with vision. And we're literally going to help do exactly what you spoke about earlier, the power of that, and reverse engineering it to make it unique to you and what your values are. And when that's going to be the first month.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm handing them off to Fred because that's how much trust I have. And I'm saying, okay, now that you have your culture established, you know who you are and where you want to go, guess what? The things that you do in your business every day, the routines, the discipline for systems, that is also culture. So now that you have your vision and where you want to go, this is what's going to be the engine that takes you there.
Yeah.
Restaurant Systems Pro. I could try to teach everybody how to do restaurant systems. I could try to recreate what Fred and David Scott Peters created,
mm-hmm.
or I could just partner with the best out there and go way further together.
Yeah, I think that would be incredibly valuable. If I had those tools when I started, it'd be a different game. Yeah.
And I think if you start, and that's I think what you said, when you started, it's a different game. And I think I encourage you, if you're listening to this and you're about to open a restaurant, or even if you had just started or opened, or maybe even if you're 2 or 3 years in, if you can do it before you open, it's easier. Would you say that's accurate or no?
Yeah.
Why?
Absolutely. Do all that before you start.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's, well, I mean, you're going to have to learn some things on the fly, but if you have all those things ironed out from the get-go, like if we had all that, just the hiring and firing thing, like the whole people, like I told you, was keeping me up at night. If we had applied what we have now, those people would never walk through these doors, you know?
But
yeah.
So I'm covering, we're calling it 4 P's: people, process, promotion, and personal growth.
Yeah.
I'm going to cover people for the first month. We're passing the community off for Fred for 2 months, 60-day training.
Yeah.
You're getting access to the software for free the first 60 days. I hope you stick with it after that because you'd be stupid not to.
Right.
And then from there, I still haven't decided who I'm partnering with promotion. Marketing. There's not a marketer out there I trust right now. I'm so afraid to pass people off or to bring people in, and I'm just so like uneasy. Right. I mean, I'm really into direct mail marketing. I believe in SMS marketing and email marketing.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's that world scares me, but we're going to find partners, or maybe I just do it on my own, or I don't know. Yeah. I'm still trying to figure that out.
That's scary territory.
Yeah. I'm literally doing like just opening a restaurant. You just got to start. right? And you got to figure it out as you go. And that's kind of what we're doing here. But I feel really confident about the culture and the process side of things. And then I'm also going to cover personal growth, where I'm bringing in, we're going to cover EOS, because I think that that is kind of like personal growth, where it's routines and rituals.
Yeah.
And communication. You're creating the same space.
That's a lot of work too.
Yeah. And it's habit. Yeah. Yeah. That's the other thing that I think is huge about personal growth, is getting into routine. I think, and all this stuff is aligned. It all stacks on top of each other. So like in order to stick with it and try to get better, I think you have to understand how the brain works.
Yeah.
So you can basically hack it and say like when you see yourself drifting or getting angry, or you just don't want to do it today because you don't feel like it. Like you have to override that mindset, you know?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to go on such a long tear. You got me excited. I feel like it's just like I'm meant to be here right now, because you're reinforcing so much of what I believe in.
Yeah, I think, you know, EOS is, there's just like, I would read all these books like Traction or Scaling Up or all these 10X Your Business or whatever it is, and they're all kind of saying the same thing. Like, but I think what EOS does is just simplifies the hell out of it. And that's why it's so attractive to me.
Yeah.
I was like, I like
it. It distills it and it makes it digestible. I like that you bring up EOS too, because I like to use this analogy with Fred and David Scott Peters. So David Scott Peters, I feel like, is kind of like the entrepreneur in the sense, not to say that Fred's not an entrepreneur, but Fred is clearly 100% also rocket fuel.
Yeah.
And rocket fuel is the person who is good at making shit happen. They're the systems minded person. Like, if you're listening to this and you're an entrepreneur and you're a visionary and you're a dreamer and you're a rah rah kind of guy and you can get people excited, you can sell the culture, you can sell the vision. That is David Scott Peters all day long.
Sure.
All day long.
Yeah.
Fred is the guy behind the scenes that made it all happen.
Yeah.
In terms of building out the systems.
Right.
And I don't know how they feel about that statement, but that's kind of my observation.
Yeah.
You know, and that's who I'm going with, the partner with on this, which makes me really excited, because there isn't a better person for the job.
Yeah. You know? He's awesome.
So yeah, he's good 100%. Choices. Yeah. I'm stoked. So let's talk about the demise of Drift. I just did say it. I'm sorry. So it's like fine. What happened? Like, bring us to that moment. Like, why did you choose to close?
Yeah, it was, it was kind of, the lease was up. It was decision time. And I think we, you know, from the pandemic, I think it started during the pandemic that we were kind of talking to the landlord like, hey, this is, you know, I got real nervous during the pandemic and I was like, I don't know. I think I got to bail out of this somehow. Like, how do we get out of here? And, you know, from then they, you know, they obviously wanted us in that center, and I decided I'm going to do everything we can. We're going to throw everything. And we went through several renditions of opening lunch, closing lunch, trying brunch, closing brunch. And it was just a matter of, you know, this doesn't make financial sense anymore. I know it's a great asset to this shopping center, and I know, you know, it wasn't like drearily slow. I always say it was kind of like the Jekyll and Hyde restaurant, like busier than ever on, you can handle on Friday and Saturday, and the rest of the week you're just scratching for, you know, getting people in for a $45 grouper on a Tuesday in the suburbs. It's a tall order. And I think that's where, you know, it didn't quite fit the market. But, I mean, no restaurant's going to close if they're killing it. You know, it was just decision time. And you quickly realize that you will put all of 110% of your energy into something that's not working, and you'll completely ignore what's working or your energy should be. And I think that's where I was. And I was just like, this has taken enough of a toll on my business life and my family life that it's like, I got to put some energy back into these things that are working.
Right.
And keep them working.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Well, good for you. I think that's really great. Just awareness.
Yeah.
You know,
nothing makes it easier. I mean, letting 50 people go. It's a heartbreaker.
That's got to be the worst part. Yeah. You hear about all these successes, all these restaurateurs, the Danny Myers of the world. You know, he's had restaurants close.
Yeah.
You know, like, if you're right now, you're batting 600.
Right.
That's pretty damn good.
Like, I like that. I like those stats.
Yeah. You're doing really good. And I think it's important to know that, like, if your dream is to open, you know, 10 restaurants, and even if they're all the same concept, like, there's going to be variables that are beyond your control that you just won't know until you know, and you have to swallow that.
Yeah.
because no matter what you do, no matter how hard you try, it's sometimes it's just going to be out of your control. And if you don't have the awareness and the what's the word I'm looking for? Not like self-awareness, but like the self-awareness to know that like it's nothing that you're doing. It's just that you tried and you were wrong. And the faster you figure that out and you accept it, sometimes like you don't want to quit, but sometimes you got to know when to.
Yeah, or you were right, but times have changed.
Right.
And that happens with Southwestern cuisine. That's happened with Asian fusion cuisine. That'll happen with whatever this is.
We live in a dynamic world. Yeah. It's constantly changing around us.
Yeah.
So what's the vision? What's the future for you?
Doug's taking a break. I promised myself I'd take 6 months.
Oh, wow. Good thing I got here just in time, huh?
Yeah. No, I'm just taking a little break of, and when I mean I'm taking a break, I'm just like, I'm going to figure it out. But as far as growth, I think Seed is a very successful restaurant. Seed would do well in any major shopping complex in the Atlanta suburbs or even in Atlanta. And that's kind of what we thought about as our growth vehicle. I've got to figure that out, whether or not that's something I personally want to take on. I mean, it's a lot, you know. I mean, your life changes dramatically, and I learned that opening a restaurant a mile down the road. If I open one 30 miles away, you know, I'm in my car, and I'm doing things. So, I got to figure that out.
Yeah. So. I don't know if we got it, and I just want to. Not that I hate to try to backpedal, but like, if you could point to one or two things about Drift, was it that the market didn't want that anymore? Was it location? Like, what do you, if you could just point to a couple of things that you learned from that? I don't know if we actually really distilled.
Yeah. Don't open a restaurant that's 5,300 square feet. It was bigger than this. Wow. It was, 230 probably with the patio. I would have done it on a smaller scale, I think, a little bit more, tighten up that concept a little bit, a little smaller raw bar and, you know, make it a little bit friendlier to the market. And I would say price point is, I mean, it's an important consideration when you venture outside of the city. You're not operating on business expense accounts, you know, and that's my bad. I'll take it on the chin for that one. But it's like people don't necessarily value the quality that you value so much. Like, I was big into everything's going to be sustainable seafood over here. It's all going to be certified by Monterey Bay. And we're like, people didn't care. They were like, I want fried shrimp for $19.
Right.
Like, I just wasn't into that.
So. You know, but I do want to commend you because I think it's really important that, again, along this vein of inspire, empower, transform the industry, we transform the world, we change the world. And I think part of it is educating the consumer.
Yeah.
And I don't know if the consumer is quite ready to take it on the chin.
Yeah.
Has to know what it costs to do the right thing. But if we're going to see, if we're going to protect our waterways, if we're going to have sustainability, there's the restaurant industry is so close to that, probably more close to it than any other industry there is. This idea of just sustainable practices and doing the right thing. If there's going to be a shift, it's going to be in educating the consumer.
Right.
So like, I commend you taking the effort to try to do the right thing because I wish more restaurants would, honestly speaking. Like, if you're not going to do the right thing, then don't fucking do it.
Yeah.
You know, like if you got to do it twice, then, you know, do it twice. Right?
That's right.
You know? That's right. So I appreciate that. So I want to acknowledge you for trying to do the right thing.
Thank you.
So you shared the vision, your personal vision, what's on, you know, the future for you. But what about generally speaking? So I see you guys are getting ready for staff. Are you doing staff meal right now? I'm sorry that I pulled you away from that.
That's all right.
I love that I get to see it, though. I wish I was documenting it. We should wrap this up so I can get in there. So I'm going to start asking you the last questions. What's one thing about your business, a value, a process, a system that you think is truly uncommon that makes you unstoppable?
Yeah, I would say our team health. I mean, that's one thing I focus a lot of energy on, is making sure we have healthy relationships in this building, and we're fostering that.
I love that. Yeah. I would love to follow up on that, but I want to make sure you can get out of here before your service starts.
No, you're good.
The mission statement is to, again, change the world by inspiring, empowering, and transforming the industry. So how have you personally transformed? Who is Doug today versus the Doug you were when you got started?
Yeah, Doug today was, or Doug yesterday was probably a little bit more worried about ego, a little bit worried about his mark on the world. I think Doug today is a lot more invested in the future of the people that work for him.
Yeah. Yeah. Along this idea of changing the world,
yeah,
what is one thing that you think the restaurant industry can do to change, to be better, and to influence? How can we be a better version of ourselves tomorrow?
Yeah, I think we need to understand that we are a lot of the population's first stop, first exposure to work. And that should be a great experience. That wasn't always the case and still isn't always the case. But I think our role in that would just help our reputation immensely.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. If you got the news, you'd be leaving this world tomorrow. All the memories of you, your work, and your restaurants would be lost with your departure. With the exception of three pieces of wisdom you could leave behind for the good of humanity and your legacy, what would those three pieces of wisdom be?
Ooh.
It's a heavy one.
Yeah, I'd say the golden rule applies.
One.
I'd say don't be afraid to reach out for help.
Two. Ooh. Dude, get out of my head. Like, I literally just wrapped up with Jen from the Giving Kitchen, and that was the biggest message, is like, we have to tell people when we need help.
Right.
Because if we don't, sometimes it's too late.
Yeah.
And like, we can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
So thank you for echoing that statement. And three.
Three, I'd say
the golden rule.
Golden rule.
Tell people when you need help.
Tell people when you need help. And yeah, never stop learning.
Great. Yeah, that's perfect, man. I love it. This was really fun. I'm so happy. I remember that you were just outside of Atlanta because I've been wanting to get you on the show. Yeah. And I really want to do it in the restaurant. It's better than doing it some obscure place that's not your restaurant, because now I can go around, I can take photos of the restaurant, I can capture who you are, your story, and your restaurant,
and
create better content with it. So I'm happy we're able to make this happen. Who do you respect and admire? Somebody that if you knew I got this person as a guest on the show, you'd be like, damn, I want to listen to that episode. They're going to teach me something.
Yeah. I mean, you already said Gino Wickman. That's been a big one. God. Let me think. Locally or
anywhere?
Anywhere. Yeah, what have I been reading?
I leave tomorrow, so. Anywhere. And I live on the road now.
Yeah, Thomas Keller.
Okay. Do you know him?
You're going to see some folks that may.
Okay.
That definitely
I am headed that way.
Yeah.
For sure. All right. Well, this was a lot of fun, man. Thank you so much for taking the time to share your story, to get vulnerable, to open up, and to pay it forward to the next generation of professionals. I really do appreciate you. How can we connect?
You can find us at www.edatc.com or stemwinebar.com.
And any social handles you want to throw out there for the young kids?
same thing, at edatseed or at stemwinebar.
All right. And yeah. I believe this is episode 1074, if you want to find it. And now is when I say there is no questioning, Doug. You are unstoppable.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers. There's another episode wrapped up here at Restaurant Unstoppable. Special thanks to our guest today, Doug Turbush, for coming on, getting vulnerable, opening up, sharing numbers, being transparent, open book, all the way, man. This is the future of Restaurant Unstoppable as we grow relationships with people across the country, as I find these badasses and we really communicate that the answer to our future is in vulnerability, is in opening up and sharing and going further together. And super stoked, and we had some really great things to say about Restaurant Systems Pro today, and I'm excited to announce that Restaurant Unstoppable is partnering with Restaurant Systems Pro beyond the partnership that you're aware of. But basically, if I'm opening a restaurant tomorrow, I am going with Restaurant Systems Pro, and I'm launching a cohort right now of restaurant owners across the country. Think of it as a group coaching, group mastermind, hybrid model where you can connect with me, other listeners of the show across the country, and the people I would be going to tomorrow if I was opening a restaurant. So you're getting access to meet a mastermind. You're getting also access to my network of experts I'd be going to mastermind with. We're going to cover things like how to be more profitable and how to build better relationships and culture in your organization. But the stuff that we're going to cover that I think doesn't get covered enough is, how do you work on you? How do you become a better version of yourself? Because once, only until you're a better version of yourself, will you, or can you expect your restaurant to flourish? So the journey starts with you. We're going to be holistic in our approach, and that's going to be starting ASAP. So if you're interested in this, email me, eric@restaurantstoppable.com. In the title, put mastermind, so I know you're interested, and we're going to be very selective with who we let into this mastermind, because we want to take people that share our values and our culture and are a right fit for what we're trying to do. So again, email me, eric@restaurantstoppable.com. In the subject, put mastermind, and I'll get you more information on that. And I can't say goodbye without saying thank you to the people who make this possible. Thank you to Jared Parisi with Sumadre Podcast for your copyright and editing and so much more. And thank you to our community manager, Callan Miola, for all the work you're doing behind the scenes to bring this community together. We're just getting started. The future is bright. That's it for today. Until next time, peace out.